Omaha Public Radio, KIOS-FM, presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Today's speaker will be Todd Sneller, the administrator of the Nebraska Ethanol Board, and Governor Heineman's representative to the Governor's Ethanol Coalition. His topic will be Ethanol 101, What Ethanol Means to You, Nebraska, and the World. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Friday, April 20th, 2007, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Doug Roseman.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Doug Roseman, a member of the Omaha Press Club Education Committee. And on behalf of our committee, I welcome you and our KIOS radio audience to today's event. Each month, the Education Committee sponsors a noon forum involving a person or subject we think will be of interest to our members and the general public. As some of you now know, you don't have to be a Press Club member to attend our events. So please spread the word about the noon forum and bring your friends with you. Today's speaker, Mr. Todd Sneller, we'll take your questions following his talk. We've got paper and pencils on the table. And so please jot down any thoughts, any questions that you would like to address to him. And they will be collected by Mr. Gary Kerr and brought to me. As we have only one microphone, I will read the question to Mr. Sneller. And if he chooses to answer, he will give you his answer. So those are the rules. Let us begin our program. It seems to me that you can't pick up a newspaper or news magazine without seeing something about ethanol in it. Today, we want to talk to you about what this means to you, the state of Nebraska, and the world. Our guest, Mr. Todd Sneller, is the administrator of the Nebraska Ethanol Board, the first state agency in the United States devoted solely to the development of the ethanol industry. And in case you weren't aware, Nebraska is the third largest ethanol-producing state in the nation and the largest producer west of the Missouri River. Mr. Sneller began his work in the Nebraska Ethanol Development Program in 1976 with what was then known as the Nebraska Gaso Hall Committee. He has served on the board of the Renewable Fuels Association and is the chair emeritus of the National Ethanol Vehicle Coalition. He currently serves on the Johns Hopkins University Advisory Panel on Defense Fuels and an EPA Technical Advisory Panel on biofuel technologies. Mr. Sneller has authored numerous articles and publications on biofuels and was a delegate and presenter at the International Symposium on Alcohol Fuels held in Stockholm, Sweden. Please join with me in welcoming Mr. Todd Sneller.
Thank you for the kind introduction, Doug. As I understand, there is a radio audience listening, and so I'm going to attempt to minimize my references to pictures, and I'll try to go with the imagine if you will reference at that point. But I do want to begin with a little bit of historical context. I'm amused that with the growth in ethanol that we've seen lately, oftentimes people will approach me and say, you ethanol guys had really a good idea a couple years ago to do this ethanol thing, and there's really a lot more history to it. And I want to begin by providing just a little bit of that historical context. Many of you may be aware that Henry Ford first designed Ford automobiles at the turn of the last century to use alcohol as well as gasoline. Many of you may not have been aware that Henry's cousin Clyde, the cousin from Kentucky, was a little alarmed at the time, at the turn of the century, when Henry started to talk about the use of Kentucky's finest for motor fuel. And after some period of negotiation, Clyde suggested to Henry that perhaps they could drink the best and drive the rest. The Nebraska legislature in 1932 had enacted a provision to provide an at-the-pump incentive to encourage the use of 10% ethanol blends. And much like we're talking today about ethanol as an economic catalyst for prosperity in agricultural states, in 1933 that concept was a reality as well. So fast forward about 80 years here, and we see this economic engine truly at work in Nebraska. And while Doug had indicated that there was going to be a reference to worldwide impact, a national impact, we really want to focus on what happens at the state level. But many of these same economic advantages, many of the same reasons why we have undertaken ethanol as a value-added economic catalyst in Nebraska, other states and other countries have done likewise. About 3 years ago, the Nebraska Department of Agriculture commissioned a report, and as I was pouring through bits and pieces of this report, several things jumped out at me, and these seem obvious now. But in about 2003, when this report came out, it was noted that unquestionably ethanol would be one of the strongest economic engines in Nebraska's future. It was at the time and would continue to be, and certainly in the past 4 years, we've seen that as the case. We've also seen that policy decisions at the federal level, whether they were the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990, which gave rise to the use of cleaner burning fuels in the country, or more recently the 2005 Energy Policy Act, were critically important to giving a foundation for the use of biofuels and ethanol in particular. And many states, including Nebraska, have done a very good job of piggybacking on federal policy, and as a result of that, having ethanol development and use expand in our respective states. And as we go to the future, one of the things that I spend many hours of the day trying to do is to communicate Nebraska's interest in having those investments take place here. And this is going to be particularly important as we move forward and this industry grows from our conventional corn base to perhaps other feedstocks that may be used. As we added incentives to the state and piggybacked on public policy, we've seen tremendous growth and investment in Nebraska, and a rapidly growing trend toward increased ethanol production. One might imagine the Nebraska experience being similar to the national experience. And indeed, we've perhaps had a faster rate of growth than many states, but many of the states in the Midwest, particularly Iowa, Illinois, Minnesota, have shared a very rapid growth in ethanol production to the point where we have become the largest ethanol-producing states in the country. Doug had mentioned that Nebraska is the third largest, but by the end of this year, we expect Nebraska will be the second largest ethanol-producing state behind only Iowa. We're seeing ethanol around the Midwest certainly occur in a lot of different communities, mainly small rural communities, but even in proximity to cities the size of Omaha, we have very large ethanol production facilities at Blair, Nebraska, for example. We're seeing in Nebraska, though, a real move toward not only areas where corn is intensely produced, but also where cattle concentrations are located. So in the case of Nebraska, we're seeing a move from the corn-producing areas of the east to the corn and cattle-producing areas west in Nebraska. And this has been good for a whole host of reasons, economically, politically, from my perspective, because many, many policymakers are now hearing from constituents who feel this has been a very important industry. And as we stand here today, as I stand here today, the ethanol production picture is one of dynamic growth, and it's unprecedented in our history in the state and nation. We, as of today, have 13 ethanol plants currently in operation. As of the first quarter of 2008, I'll show some numbers, but what you'll see is a very rapid growth that will more than double what we have today. This initial production of some 750 million gallons took us from 1985, when the first commercial ethanol plant was built in Hastings, Nebraska, to today, when 13 plants are operating, producing about 750 to 800 million gallons of ethanol. In about 11 or 12 months, we will see that number more than double. And a year or two after that, we will see probably a 50% increase in that number. So the numbers in terms of ethanol production, jobs, and economic impact are really staggering. These are plants that are currently permitted or under construction, and there are at least 16 of them that are permitted or under construction. Of those, two are very large expansions underway at the two wet milling plants. These are the corn refining operations at Blair and Columbus, but also at a dozen other locations where there's construction actively underway. And the size of these investments is enormous. In many cases, the expansions being $50 to $100 million in total capital cost, and the initial investments being in the neighborhood oftentimes of $150 to $200 million. We ask ourselves sometimes about the importance of this industry in Nebraska, and it really strikes me that the importance comes home when we ask ourselves, how often do we hear of a new business development announced in Nebraska that has a capital cost of $150 or $200 million? And when you think about that, we don't hear of that very many times. And we're going to hear about it 23 times here in Nebraska in a relatively short period of time. The capacity, as I mentioned today, is the operating capacity, the installed capacity, somewhere in the neighborhood today of about 750, 780 million gallons, using approximately 22% of the corn crop in 2006. As we take a look at plants that are under construction today, this construction season with a little warmer weather just lately has really shown a rapid increase at a couple of locations in Nebraska that were not under active construction even this winter, but today are. And with that, again, we're going to see more than a doubling of our installed capacity in the state through expansion at existing plants and through new construction that's taking place today. So we expect that in 2008, for example, we'll probably be using some 45% or more of the state's corn crop right here in the state. I've heard the term from some that the unintended consequence of all this corn use, and I take exception to that term. From my perspective, this is an intended consequence of why we're working on ethanol development in the state. It's to create a nearby market for corn. It's to reduce the time and transportation costs associated with marketing corn to the coast or even internationally, which we've relied on in the past. We are now making a market for that corn here in the state. If we take a look at permitted plants, then we have some 32 or 35 plants. It changes about weekly. I bought a brochure along, which is almost useless because it does change weekly. But the fact is we have another 30 or 35 projects that we're tracking as proposed projects, some of which have a realistic possibility of developing. Others probably won't. Historically, we've seen a number of these fall off for one reason or another and simply not develop, but many of these have a reasonable opportunity. And if all of those that are permitted today are added to those that are under construction and operation, we expect that sometime early in 2009, we might be at somewhere in the neighborhood of 3.7 billion gallons of ethanol production. It wasn't until 2006 that the nation hit that number, and 2 years later, the state of Nebraska alone might make that contribution, at which point we would be using nearly all the corn produced in the state based on 2006 corn production statistics. And we're likely to continue to see this happen. Now, this has been really every policymaker's dream. If your goal was to create economic activity in a livestock-producing sector, whether it be dairy or beef like Nebraska, we've got that job done here with the high-protein feeds that come when we refine corn into ethanol. If we're interested in stimulating the transportation sector and with one of the nation's railroads headquartered in Omaha, clearly that is of interest to us. And we see on the Union Pacific Railroad's website this morning 3,000 jobs that are open. And so we are continuing to create a huge number of jobs. And if you read financial news within the last 24 hours, you have seen that the additional capacity the Union Pacific is hauling in ethanol is one that is in large part responsible, according to their account, of the profitability report that came out this week. If you're taking a look at the quality of jobs here, we have a need for microbiologists, we have a need for engineers, we have a need for grain merchandisers, we have a need for people who are skilled tradespeople. So it really is an opportunity for us to not only create those jobs, but to retain people here to fill those jobs. This is one of those industries that's really well suited for our smaller communities. It's not likely that Plainview, Nebraska or Trenton, Nebraska is going to be able to attract a microchip plant, but they both attracted ethanol plants, and those are $100 to $170 million capital investments creating some very nice quality jobs in some of our state's smallest communities. We've seen the fact that as they calculate the first and second year of taxes, but particularly the impact on their school funds, there's a massive infusion of tax revenues coming into school funds and a local tax base, which obviously adds not only to the revenues that come in, but to the diversity of the tax base. And we're seeing really the concept of value-added agriculture epitomized by this idea of taking raw material and converting it into high-value products. We're also seeing a reversal in a trend that historically had been a bit of a problem for Nebraska and other states with agricultural-based economies, and that is that we've historically had a tough time bringing capital into the state from sources outside the state. It's not been a good flow of capital outside of Lincoln and Omaha in particular. And so we've seen a reverse in that. There's a huge flow of capital coming into the state that's helped to fuel the growth of these ethanol plants. And in addition to that, these become really structures of infrastructure for allied industries. And so there's a huge opportunity, whether they be food or feed-related or chemical-related activities, they're really well-suited for partnerships. None better than the example we see just 20 miles from here at Blair, where that campus now is home to about a dozen different companies from around the world. So as we take a look down the road, we're really seeing something I think is important for all of us to understand, especially as I'm speaking in Omaha today, because this is fairly easy to understand out in Cambridge or Trenton, but sometimes in Lincoln and Omaha, we really tend to view ethanol as an ag thing. And I've seen probably the best evidence of this in discussions with state legislators, particularly those from Lincoln and Omaha who view this as an ag thing or a farm thing, not understanding that there's an enormous amount of business being done by Omaha law firms, Omaha engineering firms, fabricators of large components that are located in Lincoln or Omaha. So it really is a cross-sector industry and is affecting a lot of Nebraskans. Imagine, if you will, the different types of jobs that are involved here. From a fabrication standpoint, companies like Baylin and Columbus reported the best year in many, many years at their grain storage and grain conveying operations around the state in 2006, and they expect 2007 perhaps will likely be better than that. Chief Industries, again, another fabricator of grain bins and grain handling equipment, a massive gear up to components that they're fabricating for ethanol plants, and GSI out of Illinois, formerly headed by Howard Buffett, an Omaha Sun, a company that reported, again, record earnings based on new activity in the ethanol sector. And service providers, too, not only fabricated components made at a number of locations in Nebraska, but our engineering firms in Lincoln and Omaha, surveying firms in Holders, Nebraska, law firms across the state. So the professional sector is seeing an enormous amount of new activity in the ethanol business. And, again, it's not Cousin Floyd shoveling grain down at the elevator. It really is high tech. It really is cross-sector in terms of the different areas of professional skills and fabricated components that it involves. The report card today has been very good. If we take a look at the number of jobs created, this is an important thing, not only in Lincoln and Omaha, where job creation obviously is important in professional sectors, but probably even more important in our smaller communities, where retaining youth and trying to bring people back to communities is really an important part of their sustainability, and they all recognize that. The most conservative number we've been able to find in terms of job creation impact comes from the chief economist at Nebraska Public Power District, Donis Peterson. And in his projections as a regional economist, he indicates that for every 100 direct jobs, there's probably 65 induced jobs that are specifically the result of activities at that ethanol plant. And while that's the most conservative, we decided to go ahead and adopt that for purposes of illustration to show that at the plants that we have currently operating and under expansion, we've got about 1,100 direct and indirect jobs or so. And it took us from 1985 till 2007 to develop the people needed for those jobs. In the next 11 months, we're going to have to take double that number, about 1,300 new jobs that are directly and indirectly related to these ethanol plants that are being expanded and built in the state today, and get those things filled. Now, if we were in Lincoln or Omaha and the challenge was get 1,300 qualified people to come in and fill jobs, you know, we might be able to do that. But we're talking about getting people to Cambridge and to Plainview and to Madrid, Nebraska. And that is a challenge. These are great communities all. We've found many nice places for people to live in small communities in the state, but we're hearing a few stories of culture shock when people move from Omaha to Madrid. And about 6 months later, they're finding out that, indeed, it is somewhat different than living in Omaha had been. And while it's a great job, they are looking for amenities. And so we've got to do a good job of creating not only the aura of working in a high-tech sector, i.e. ethanol, but also the benefits of living in smaller communities need to be experienced and conveyed as part of this recruitment effort. So we're working very hard to try to meet this need. It's coming at us very quickly. I realized about 2 years ago that this was something coming faster than any of us had realized, and so I took a few steps to try to be proactive, because we could see that these were going to be jobs that, again, we might fill in Lincoln or Omaha, but we needed to get some skilled professional people trained and prepared to move to other places in the state. Some of the examples, of course, are cited previously, but there are a number of others. And I'm repeatedly hearing from the grain companies, for example, the seed companies, about the need for grain merchandisers and grain specialists and how important that is. And so it's become one of those challenges to fill these kinds of jobs in rural communities. These are jobs that are pretty well compensated. Again, in Lincoln and Omaha standards, $50,000 a year average salary, maybe considered a moderate salary, but that's an average salary. It went up about 40% last year in terms of the top four or five positions at the plants. And these are really good jobs when we start putting them in our community with 550 or 1,100 people. So we're getting skilled people that are being compensated well up and down the spectrum at these plants. We've seen the same activity in the transportation sector. And I talked to the business manager of the Steamfitters Union in Omaha here yesterday, and he talked about the enormous demand for skilled tradespeople, steamfitters in particular, at these ethanol plants in Iowa and Nebraska right now. It's very difficult to fill all those job requirements, but they're doing their very best, and their members are doing very well in terms of the financial compensation associated with those jobs. So as we look forward, how do we meet these challenges? There are a number of challenges along with the opportunity here. We right now have ethanol plant construction at a historic high level, just an intense pace of activity. But while that's all good, and we might hope to see some focus on that, we are competing today with the refining sector, huge amount of activity, retrofits of current U.S. refineries, and construction of a couple of new refineries down in Texas right now, which are taking many of the same people. If you want steam fitters, if you want fabricated components, we are competing with projects like Council Bluffs Mid-American Energy Project, huge addition to the state of Iowa, good for area jobs here and stuff, but we're competing in those sectors, power plants, refining industry, and ethanol right now for many of the same components, raw materials, and people. We're taking a look at the fact that ethanol is a relatively new sector compared to power plants and refineries, and so, again, a little more of a challenge drawing people to this sector. We're taking a look at the fact that many of these jobs are indeed in rural areas, as I've seen, and that this is an immediate need for these jobs. In the next 11 months, 1,300 positions have got to be filled. We're seeing a rapid expansion, so it's not like we're going to a stagnant pool of people to draw from. This has been a recruitment effort that's been actively underway for at least 2 years, and so we're already somewhat strained as we go into that pool, and we're seeing that it's fairly geographically limited. You can get these jobs in Iowa or Missouri or Nebraska or South Dakota or Kansas, but it is in the Midwest region, so a lot of intense recruitment activity in a relatively small geographic area. And we've really got to do a better job. The ethanol sector must be doing a better job to create awareness about the business opportunities, but also about the salaries that these jobs are paid and the type of jobs. We've not done a good job in terms of the ethanol plant story of telling people what's behind the fence there. Our inclination to think is, well, that's the kind of job that Cousin Floyd, who was really good with his shovel down at the elevator scooping grain, must have. We've not said that these are microbiological jobs, that these are grain merchandising jobs, that these are jobs for engineers as well. So we need to do a good job of conveying the fact that there is a high-tech element to this as well. So taking a look at these challenges, I'm trying to cobble together some of the resources that we have in Nebraska and to get them focused on this effort. And part of this is an immediate need, the training need. How do you quickly move up your number three person at the plant who's a pretty good shovel handler and can manage a boiler operation pretty well and make that person a manager today? You've got to go to the community college nearby. You've got to get some intense, quick training. The Job Partnership Training Act, which is a federal fund that's administered by the Nebraska Department of Economic Development, is one source of money for that. $250,000 has been put away immediately to provide support for training needs right now at ethanol plants in the state. We need to have a statewide educational effort and training effort. So we were able to pull together a $2 million grant that was awarded to Northeast Community College up in Norfolk. They're heading up a statewide program that will, in November of this year, the last quarter of this year, will begin with a new degree program that's available at any community college in the state. It'll be an Associate of Science degree. We're working very hard with the state colleges and with the University of Nebraska to make sure that the curriculum in that two-year program will transfer in full to a four-year degree if someone chooses to move on to get some additional education. With the help of the AIM Institute here in Omaha and our activities with the community college, this CareerLink.com program has been used as a free program for the ethanol plants to post jobs and for ethanol recruiters to take a look at those jobs, for interested parties seeking employment to take at those jobs, and for internships to be filled. We're really working aggressively at an at an internship program that's worth credit and that is a paid position so that employers can evaluate prospective candidates and so that students or others who are interested in working at this plant can get a taste of what goes on behind the gates and maybe become enthused about a career in the ethanol sector. We're taking a look at what else we can do with manufacturing services. I was able to get Department of Economic Development to pay for an intern, and a bright young man from Omaha is working with us this week, and we'll be working through the summer and into the fall in identifying of all the components that are going into an ethanol plant and all the services required to support that, which Nebraska manufacturers and service providers can do those things that are currently being done by companies outside of the state. How can we better seize that opportunity? So we're going to cross-reference all of these products, all these services, and find Nebraska manufacturers who can do more of that so that we can better capture this opportunity that's underway today. And we're going to, at the same time, create a better awareness, we hope, across those sectors of this opportunity. So as we look down the road, some of the things that continue to be a challenge are engineering services. 2 years ago, I met with HDR, I met with Kirk and Michael, I met with Olson Associates in Lincoln, and I asked them to consider getting more involved in ethanol development. And they're big companies, they were busy companies anyway, but slowly they agreed that this is a sustainable opportunity and one that was good for them, business in the backyard. And those companies have seized that opportunity and have applied many of their engineering skills and resources to these projects now. And that's one of the things that we're short on today is engineers who have specific expertise in related areas and can do this work. It's the only way we're going to debottleneck the system right now. Today it takes about 22 months to construct an ethanol plant. 2 years ago it took 11 months. We're short on people, we're short on engineering talent, we're short on fabricated components. In large part because we're competing with other sectors, but we need to have more of the skilled trades people, we need to have more engineering talent. And we've got to get that focused on this sector in order to debottleneck the situation. It's the only thing, in my view, that will help us bring down the creep in capital cost of these plants that we've seen over the last 2 years. We've also seen a real need here to make sure that we understand the integration of this corn, cattle, ethanol concept. Nebraska is the only state in the country today that can feed all of this wet, high-protein byproduct that comes from ethanol plants to nearby cattle herds. There's no other state that can do that. So we have a unique opportunity to have a better feed product, to feed our cattle and support the cattle industry in the state, and to make sure that we're doing this in a way that uses less energy. So it's a smart thing for us to focus on. At the same time, we need to make sure that the university faculty who are known around the country, around the world, are replaced and that we continue the level of expertise we've had. In 1965, Terry Klopfenstein was recruited to come to the university faculty, and he is the professor in the area of ruminant nutrition who gave rise to the notion of using distillers' feeds to fatten cattle efficiently, and it is a very efficient way to do that, and it's been essential to the economics of ethanol production. Terry has been trying to retire for about 4 years now. He's got one young colleague, but they're continually having cutbacks in the ag sector for a couple of different reasons. One is we haven't really focused on productivity of agriculture because in recent years, who's needed more corn? We're trying to find places overseas where we can get rid of corn. Why would we focus research dollars on growing more corn in Nebraska? Well, today, that bird has come home to roost, and we need to be focusing on what we can do efficiently and sustainably in the production area. As Ken Kassman from the University of Nebraska's Energy Center points out, the faculty across the country who knew and really understood production agriculture are all ready to retire. In the next 5 to 7 years, all of those people who are really good at that area will have retired. And so we've got a real challenge here in terms of making sure that we understand the research needs, and we've got to make sure that we develop the capability to continue to do well in this ethanol sector. I mentioned to you the training programs at the community colleges that we've launched. The fostering of a competitive environment in terms of business is going to be very important to us in a couple of different areas. One is that all states are competing for this business. And one of the questions you may ask today is, why would we subsidize this business when it's doing so well? Well, the answer to that is that states are competing for this business. We all are trying to actively compete for these $150 million projects. It's as easy to go to Iowa as it is to Nebraska. So if we want to have those investments made in Nebraska, we've got to have a competitive business environment. So that's really been the role of incentives. But we've also got to do a good job in terms of facilitating development. And our permitting process in some states is better than it is in other states. Nebraska tends to have a bit of a a reputation today as a state where it's difficult and time-consuming to permit plants. And so we've got to continue to make sure that the Department of Environmental Quality and the other regulatory agencies continue to get a flow of bright young people who can quickly evaluate and process permits, and we've got to make sure that that's our attitude so that we do this responsibly and sustainably, but do it in a businesslike fashion. And finally, in terms of just the transportation policy things that we're going to take a look at today, some of my friends at First National Bank of Omaha and I had a chance to talk about some of these issues and what a challenge that is today. We're putting many more products on rail than we did before. We're putting many more products on truck than we did before. And those ethanol gallons that are going into trucks must be on hazmat-qualified trucks driven by hazmat-qualified drivers, which are tougher to recruit than a conventional truck driver. So we've got a great deal of challenge in the transportation sector, both in the rail side and in the truck side, to make sure that we keep up with this growing need for efficiently moved products and materials. As we look down the road, then, it's my view that given the great environment we have in Nebraska, Nebraska will continue to focus on ethanol and biofuel recruitment. The Lincoln Star this morning carried an announcement about a new biofuel proposal for western Nebraska. It's a biodiesel plant there. We'll probably continue to see some growth in that area, not at the pace we're seeing in ethanol today, but certainly interest in biofuels generally because state and public policies are continuing to support evolution of those fuels and those products. We're going to continue to see a focus on rural communities and what we can do to make sure that we've got a good environment for fostering other allied industries in those communities and making sure that we've got a skilled pool of candidates that can work at these facilities. And we're trying to make sure that as we go forward, we take full advantage of the ethanol opportunity in Nebraska and just not grab the obvious, because there are a number of manufacturing opportunities, employment opportunities that will generate additional revenues, additional opportunities in the state, and as a result of that, the state's economy will continue to become healthier and more diverse as we capitalize on this area. So those are the primary points I wanted to make today as I had a chance to visit with you, and glad to visit with you about any questions you may have, and encourage you to continue to ask questions, particularly among media who make pronouncements from time to time that haven't been challenged, the most recent of which came from Stanford University, and really a preposterous report. And I think part of my job on a day-to-day basis is to make sure that we have good factual information, and I hope to work with many of you, and particularly in media efforts, to make sure that happens. Thank you for your interest and attention, and be glad to respond to any questions.
Mr. Todd Sneller, thank you very much. And we do have some questions, and if anyone else has any more, we have paper and pencil on the table. Please jot them down. And the first question that we have, is it true that it takes more energy to produce ethanol than the use of ethanol saves?
That's a good question, and one that appears repeatedly in the media. It's one we've addressed literally since the 1970s. And the answer to that is no, energy produced from ethanol actually yields more than the fossil input. And there really are only two scientists, one a bug scientist from Cornell that you read a lot about, and one an oil scientist from UC Davis that you read some about. Other than that, all scientists from Argonne National Laboratories, the scientists from U.S. Department of Energy, U.S. Department of Agriculture, University of Nebraska, Michigan State University, Iowa State University, literally all the land-grant universities, have evaluated best current practices. They take a look at how you balance energy inputs and outputs, and they've concluded that in the most conservative case, for every unit of fossil energy input into ethanol production, there's at least 1.3 units of output. USDA indicates that number is about 1.68, but the most conservative estimate is 1.3 yield from one unit of input.
The next question is, the Stanford report was talked about on CNBC this morning. Can you add more information to that?
I can. A professor decided to create a model, and that model is based on what is projected to be the ethanol use and the air quality conditions in California in 2020. The California Air Resources Board will tell you that after years of work, they can't predict what will happen by 2010. But this professor has a model that by 2020 he feels will accurately predict the impact of using ethanol. And in fact, what we see today is a real guessing game going on about what the specific environmental conditions will be in any area of the country, and particularly in California. California has the cleanest burning gasoline, and California has decided that despite the clean burning gasoline, which in my view is an oxymoron, but the California refining industry believes that there is such a thing, California policymakers have chosen one additive to help improve air quality and to help mitigate some of the air pollution problems, and that additive is ethanol.
We have two questions pertaining to water. The first is, how big a problem will the increased use of water be in the future? And is anyone studying the availability of water for the continued ethanol expansion, as well as the effects on the water quality?
Both very good, timely, and topical questions. As recently as 2 years ago, when we would look at ethanol plant sites, we had a list of about 10 key things that were essential to a site. Water was probably number 8 on that list. We look at water quality and quantity. Today, water is probably number 2 on that list. The water policy and water administration is occurring primarily at the local level. The state's involved a number of agencies, including Department of Natural Resources, Water Resources Agency, and Natural Resource Agencies at the local level are having to authorize water use decisions in their respective areas of the state, and that will continue to be the case. So it is more of a challenge today, but it's important to understand that when we hear about water and ethanol, typically we're hearing about a bigger concern associated with irrigated corn rather than the processed water used at ethanol plants. In the best case today, we've seen water audits at Trenton, Nebraska, for example, which is about a 4-year-old plant where 2.88 gallons of water are used to make 1 gallon of ethanol. 5 years ago, that was about 8 gallons of water to make 1 gallon of ethanol. Literally in a year's time, we'll be at about 1.5 gallons of water to make 1 gallon of ethanol. So the technology continues to increase. And probably most importantly, we're seeing the fact today that in terms of all water use in the state, if all the plants that I've described today were actually built and fully in operational, those plants would require less than 0.2% of our water used in the state each year. So it's a relatively small amount used in that manufacturing sector. A much larger amount obviously used to irrigate corn, and that's one of the reasons I think we'll continue to see an emphasis on hybrids that do better in low water conditions.
We've got three related questions here. We hear so much about switchgrass to make ethanol. What is the future for it and other cellulose to make ethanol? Are the plants being built adaptable so they could accommodate other grains, switchgrass? And will we be seeing the use of sugar beets for ethanol? Brazil has gone this route.
Brazilians have done an excellent job of using sugar cane, actually. Sugar is easily convertible to ethanol, and in the growing conditions in South America, that's become the crop of choice, particularly in Brazil. Sugar beets were analyzed about 20 years ago at the Western Experiment Extension Station in the Scotts Bluff area, and actually we took a look at a New Zealand fodder beet variety, which is a fodder beet that's able to produce high yields of very crude sugar. You wouldn't want to eat this stuff, but if you just wanted to get net sugar per acre, it yields about 3 times more sugar than corn per acre. The problem, of course, is that we have about a one-month campaign where we're compiling sugar beets, and we have about a 6-week shelf life for those beets. So it would be hard to become dependent upon that single feedstock. We do have plants designed today to use multiple feedstocks. A good example is even our oldest plant in the state, Chief Ethanol, which can interchangeably use corn and grain sorghum. We tend to have plants focused primarily on corn because the economics of corn have been better, and the yields are slightly better with corn. In taking a look at some of these new different types of esoteric feedstocks, we'll see an emphasis on those, but my guess is that corn and other grains will continue to be the predominant feedstock source for the foreseeable future. Huge amount of research today going into products like switchgrass, but in my view, probably forestry products and waste materials that are currently being gathered for another reason will be more likely candidates. Switchgrass is something that can be used. Technically, it can be used economically today. It's not in the cards in all likelihood.
How important is ethanol to Nebraska agriculture? What about the byproducts fed to cattle?
Good question. I tried to talk about the economic impact, which is immense regardless of whether you're taking a look at the impact on corn farmers or cattle producers or local communities. But the cattle industry across the state today would concede that one of the most important developments in recent years has been the addition of distillers' feeds, particularly wet feeds that can be used with really poor quality roughage. The cattle sector is probably most immune of any other livestock feeding sector from the increase in corn prices that we're seeing today. in large part because they can feed real poor quality roughage. Some of the most obstinate cattle feeders I know in Nebraska that wouldn't concede an inch several years ago with regard to whether or not ethanol is a good thing to be doing in Nebraska today will tell you that they've remained profitable in the last 5 years of drought because wet distillers feeds, a high-protein feedstock, are able to supplement really poor quality roughage, including real poor quality hay and grasses. And it's that combination now where we're literally taking these wet feeds out to cattle populations that are outside of confined areas and making it available as a feed that's really given rise to the profitability in cattle.
What is the future use of 85% ethanol fuel? Will there ever be enough vehicles that can use 85% or stations that sell the fuel? And related to that, are the big oil companies fighting to keep ethanol off the market?
E85 is really an area of significant potential growth, but it is one that's going to require a huge commitment in infrastructure. As you take a look at how fuels are marketed today, it's primarily the petroleum industry that buys, transports, blends, and dispenses fuel. And so they're going to be involved in making decisions about which fuels get in their pumps. And so E85 has been far more successful with independent marketers than it has been with branded marketers. We're going to continue to have to see some really smart innovations in E85 marketing to really make it profitable and really make it economic for consumers. We have, for example, Missouri Farmers Association, MFA Oil, in collaboration with Verisun, which is one of our nation's newest and larger ethanol producers, who are today making E85 blends available in Missouri and in Iowa and in South Dakota for as much as 45 cents a gallon below the cost of unleaded gasoline. Now, today you see a number on a sign that's at 189, and it gets your attention given the fact that most of the gasoline prices are in the neighborhood of 269 or 279. And so that kind of pricing where we use the efficiencies of the ethanol producer working directly with a local petroleum marketer so that these products aren't transported to a terminal first and then come back to retail, but rather go directly to retail from the plants or a blending facility will be the far more efficient way to market E85. We've got about 6 million flex fuel vehicles in the country today on the road. It's predicted that by 2010, all domestic manufacturers will make at least 50% of every automobile and truck as a flexible fuel vehicle, and that really gives then rise to opportunities for blending something other than E85 or E10. There are a number of blender pump innovations going on at a couple of South Dakota Senex stations today where the blender pumps are able to dispense the percentage of your choice, 20, 30, 40% blends of ethanol with gasoline, depending on which economics, which horsepower, which volume you would like to use. So we're seeing some innovations in that area, but they're coming very slowly, in large part because of some regulatory hurdles by Underwriters Laboratory and because of petroleum marketing decisions by the oil companies.
Please respond to the criticism that ethanol requires more energy to produce than it contains.
I tried to touch on that earlier, and again, just to reiterate, really most calculations that one sees today by credible sources indicate that the energy input is less than the energy output of ethanol. And when you consider that, you know, energy is a costly commodity today, and if you were trying to operate a plant, you probably would do everything in your power to reduce energy consumption. You would make sure that any hot water or steam in the plant got used. You would make sure that you were looking at efficient ways to capture exhaust gases and recombust those in the process. You'd be taking a look at a whole host of things like not drying distillers' feeds, but rather marketing them wet to reduce your natural gas consumption. You might even take a look at a model at Mead, Nebraska today where livestock manure goes into anaerobic digesters and fuels 110% of the plant's needs with methane generated from livestock waste in a small ethanol plant on the front end of that facility. So we're seeing some real innovations in that area, and because of the cost of energy, we'll continue to see that trend.
Corn prices have risen dramatically because of increased ethanol production. Doesn't this also drive up consumer prices, especially for meat and poultry?
There's been a modest increase, but I've told the corn producers, quit apologizing. Once in 11 years, it's okay to make a profit. I think as we take a look at what those impacts are, and I'm working with a number of other co-authors on a publication on food, feed, fiber, and fuel, and what is the impact of corn price increases. They're modest increases. Literally, in a $4 box of corn flakes, there's 4 cents worth of corn. And so if that $2 bushel went to $4, you might see a 2 cent change in a box of corn flakes. We might see a pound of pork go up 6 cents a pound. We might see a pound of beef go up a penny and a half a pound. But probably the most susceptible would be poultry. Poultry is likely to increase more than either than beef or pork, but certainly not significantly, particularly compared to energy costs. I'm a bit alarmed and a little bit confused by the fact that there's this huge focus on what happens with food costs when, in fact, our pocketbook is going to be nominally affected by that price increase. And yet we've seen in Omaha and Lincoln about a 40-cent a gallon increase in retail gasoline prices since March 1st. And where's the outrage here? And so I think that the fact that we are displacing some of that more costly petroleum with more efficiently produced ethanol that brings with us the other allied benefits, that still remains a smart investment for Midwestern states in particular.
Is it true that if all U.S. corn production were used, it would satisfy only 12% of current U.S. fuel needs? Is it wise to use a food crop for fuel?
It is pretty close to say that our corn production as we know it now would be in the neighborhood of 12 or 15% displacement. So when you hear the president talk about a 35% displacement, if you take a look at what he said, he was talking about alternative fuels and domestic fuels, not biofuels exclusively. So we're probably able to produce about 15 or 17 in a best case if we strip the fiber out of the corn kernel and use that in addition to the starch, maybe 20 billion gallons of ethanol from corn by 2012 or somewhere in that neighborhood. So if we take a look at will we be using other products like switchgrass or forestry waste or municipal wastes that are currently in landfills across the country, in all likelihood, we will start moving that direction using some of those other materials. So we've got to be smart about using corn. We know how to use it efficiently. It can be an energy crop and a food crop. And so I don't think we need to sacrifice one or the other if we use smart process technologies.
If ethanol is so good, why is the fuel subsidized at the rate it is? And why are there duties and tariffs to keep Brazilian ethanol out of the U.S.?
Both good questions. The subsidies, I prefer to call them incentives for ethanol, is really to get that product used in place of gasoline. When you look at the initial rationale for providing these incentives, it was to offset a more expensive product. And if you're a petroleum marketer and you have the chance to use your product, petroleum, or this new interloper, ethanol, in all likelihood, you're going to use ethanol. You're going to use gasoline. We're not going to see much ethanol integration. So the goal was to incentivize the petroleum industry. Those federal incentives go directly to the manufacturer of the finished fuel. That is the petroleum marketer who takes the two components, ethanol and gasoline, blends them together. That's the entity that qualifies for that federal incentive. It makes that product less expensive than gasoline. It provides a motivation to sell a non-traditional product coming from somebody else's manufacturing source, and it's been an effective way to integrate it into the marketplace. The Brazilian tariffs were initially put up in much the same way in 1985 because there was a concern that in its infancy, when we're trying to induce investment in a new industry, what might happen if we saw a flow of ethanol coming from some other source and it jeopardized these investments. And from a public policy standpoint, you've got to agree probably that that is a good idea to make sure that if we're making these capital investments that they're secure investments made domestically. And that continues to be part of the rationale today. Brazilian ethanol has got to pay a tariff when it comes into the U.S. that offsets that 51 cent a gallon that's provided when that Brazilian ethanol is blended with gasoline in the U.S. So it's really an offset far more than it is a penalty.
Can plants that currently make ethanol from corn be converted to make it from cellulose?
A very good question. About 7 years ago, the U.S. Department of Energy launched a corn bridge to ethanol program, and the goal there was to take a look at conventional corn ethanol plants that existed at that time, including two in Nebraska that qualified for the program, one at Hastings and one at York. And they went to the engineering firms of choice, and they said, we'll support the financial cost of you pre-designing the front end of a plant that would take corn stalks or Milo Stover and see if you could integrate that into your existing dry mill plant. And that work was done, and the conclusion was absolutely it can be done. It's going to be expensive. It's going to be a little time-consuming. The back end of the plant's going to be essentially the same, but the front end of the plant is going to be different. The bigger problem probably is in the logistics of moving all that material. You know, who among us would be paid, would be willing to go out and make a second trip out to the field and pick up corn stalks? Who's willing to incur that energy cost? Who's willing to incur that time? Who's willing to have their equipment use more hours of the year for those activities? If that's going to happen, if you're going to be compelled to do that, you're going to have to be paid handsomely for that material. The current economic models indicate that maybe you could provide, pay $20 or $25 a ton for these materials. I dare you to find a farmer who would go back to the field and do that for less than $50 a ton. So while the U.S. Department of Energy said, what a great idea, look at the economics of this, what they forgot to do was ask the raw material provider, are you willing to do this at that price? And the answer today is no, thank you. And so until we get other materials, let's use the example of forest residue that's already at a pulping plant or a paper mill. It's already there. It's already been collected. Now you've got this mountain of waste. That might be a good raw material to be using. Baltimore, brownfield plant, currently taking a look at a mountain of tires there. Huge waste problem. What do you do with those tires? People have paid you to take them, paid you to store them, paid you to get them out of the way, and they mount up. Well, we can take a new gasification technology. We can use a new technology to convert those tires into a chemical stream from which you can extract ethanol and other components, and you can use the gases to fuel your plant. So there's a number of technologies out there. There's a variety of materials out there that can be used. But again, the technology issue today is not even as intensely important as the economics issue. Corn is economic in North America. Sugar is economic in South America. Those will be the favored feedstocks in the future.
Please address the benefits of new capital from outside investment in ethanol.
I sometimes am quoted as saying maybe that's not a great idea, because I oftentimes hear from state legislators and others who are saying, why aren't Nebraskans owning these plants? Well, virtually all Nebraskans have had a chance to take an ownership interest in plants, and if they've chosen not to do that, that was their prerogative. The fact is, this is a hot sector right now. Capital's looking for a home. Many times the plants that have been built in an area will see contributions to the first plant, and that really taps out the financial capabilities in that area. So the next plant that comes around, maybe 15 miles down the road, is starting to go knock on those same doors. And meantime, there's a fund drive from a plant 30 miles away. And I will guarantee you that out in the country, those doors have been knocked on a whole bunch of times. And those who wanted to make the investments have probably made those investments. So if we were depending only on Nebraska capital, we wouldn't have seen this many plants built. So we've got to have flow of capital from external sources. Oftentimes that's done in partnership with local investors and local communities. Sometimes it's not, but I think that's almost the exception today rather than the rule. We'll probably see more of those plants built because the magnitude of these investments today are no longer the 50 or 60 million dollar plant, but rather 150 or 200 million dollar plants. So that flow of capital has been intensely important to continue to see growth in this sector that I think otherwise would have been inhibited if we'd relied only on statewide sources.
The next to last question that I have is, compare the impact of Nebraska's use of corn for ethanol to U.S. exporting, especially seed, the impact on seeds.
I'm not sure I understand the impact on seeds.
On feed impact.
I think probably the best benefit of having a nearby market is it tends to be a more aggressive market. When we take a look at how corn was originated and how it was paid for in years past, what you see is that the grain elevators in particular, because they had storage capability, would become buyers of opportunity. Come fall, those of you who have some farming background would know that you've got to get a crop out of the bin to make way for the new crop. And so you had to move that commodity out of there. The elevators were happy to take that grain. And that's how this whole idea of cheap exports really became a huge international market for Nebraska. But when you take a look at our geographic position and figure what it takes in terms of transportation costs to get to the coast and then to get to China or some other place that was a customer, there's an immense amount of time and money and transportation costs associated with that. So by creating a nearby market, we reduce the cost, the time, the transportation cost, and really create a much more vibrant market. We've seen in years past when early on I, for example, took a look at the country elevator prices in Hamburg, Iowa versus the cash prices paid by the little ethanol plant in Hamburg, Iowa, every day 5 or 7 cent premium paid for corn purchased by that ethanol plant. They have to feed that plant every day. They can't go a day and not feed that plant. They're the aggressive buyers in the area. They become the market maker. And that's particularly true as we've seen these plants get bigger and develop more of an appetite for corn.
We just received another one, so we now have two to go. What impact is this having on ag land values?
Clearly, we're seeing rent prices go up. We're seeing, I think, many farmers who, if ever they were going to sell a farm and retire, would agree that 2007 may be the time to do that. It's having a huge impact. And certainly, if it were not for the profitability we're seeing in increased corn revenues, it would be tough to be paying those lease rates. But we are seeing a real appetite for land acquisitions. We're seeing a capability to pay for the higher land values. And clearly, we're going to see a lot of small communities generate more and more revenue for local operations. This is going to be a boon for many of the rural parts of the state because we're going to see increased revenues coming as a result of the increased land values.
And the last question. Some investors have made huge profits on ethanol plants. Are those profits still possible, or are we in danger of overbuilding?
Well, I'm not an investment counselor, and I didn't sleep at a Holiday Inn last night, so I probably shouldn't offer much advice on that topic. I will say that there's some people who've gotten fabulously wealthy. I am not one of those. But I do admire those who put capital at risk and were rewarded for that, particularly at a time when this was not such a certain thing as it is today. We're still seeing very good profitability in the ethanol sector. We're still seeing a lot of capital invested there because it is profitable relative to other investment options. And I am convinced that we're going to continue to see profit and growth in that sector. It's got to be disciplined. It's got to be smart. One of the things that I try to counsel, especially local boards of directors who are associated with these plants, is diversify your membership. Don't make sure that everybody doesn't have the same background. You don't need one more corn producer, one more cattle feeder on there. You need a banker. You need an attorney. You need somebody who understands real estate. So diversity and discipline in these boards is going to be very important. The capital firms that have been involved with this, those with a lot of experience, are not going to have that challenge. They know and understand that. But I think some of our farmer-owned cooperatives, some of the smaller local investments, really have got to understand the need for discipline, making sure that they get debt amortized, making sure that they have capital reserves, making sure they're looking at new technology and the things that will continue to sustain their investment. And I think if they do that with discipline and do that with smarts, they'll continue to be successful and profitable.
That concludes the question and answer session. And our thanks go out to our guest today, Mr. Todd Sneller, and to our audience here at the Omaha Press Club and our KIOS radio audience. Thank you for listening today. The Noon Forum is now adjourned.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Today's speaker was Todd Sneller, the administrator of the Nebraska Ethanol Board and Governor Heineman's representative to the Governor's Ethanol Coalition. He spoke on the topic, Ethanol 101, What Ethanol Means to You, Nebraska, and the World. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Friday, April 20th, 2007, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club holds these noontime educational forums each month. The next forum will be held on Thursday, May 24th at 12 noon. At that time, the guest speaker will be Brent Bowen, director of the Aviation Institute at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and co-author of the 2007 National Airline Quality Rating Study. He'll talk about the report and the performance of the nation's airlines. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.